Closed, please. So everyone got a handout that needs one?
Yeah.
Right, so the topic of the next... Oh, I probably ought to just give a housekeeping notice that the lectures on Thursday and Friday are again going to be swapped between cosmology and GR. So I have to leave a bit earlier than I thought on Friday. So I'll be taking the 9 and 11.30 slot, Latham's slot on Thursday, and Latham will be taking my 9 a.m. slot on Friday. Okay? So just so you know. So the next two lectures, we're going to look at what's known as Kaluza-Klein theory. Yesterday, I sort of introduced extra dimensions by talking about black holes and looked at the higher dimensional generalization of the Schwarzschild black hole in a little bit of detail and showed that it was quite analogous to 4D Schwarzschild. We calculated temperature, partition function, entropy. And it, all the calculations were very similar to Schwarzschild. It was just numerical factors that changed. I also said a little bit about rotating black holes, told you about Myers-Perry, and then in very heuristic terms mentioned other solutions such as black rings, black brains, and so on. So I want to look in a bit more detail now at extra dimensions in general and how we describe them, given that we see our world as being four-dimensional, okay? So, for the next two lectures, I'm going to look at aspects of what's generally called Kaluza-Klein theory. So, the basic problem that you have when you're thinking of extra dimensions is really how to describe why we don't see them. Mathematically, there's no problem with doing gravity in any number of dimensions, because when I was setting up the whole formalism of differential geometry, I mean, I emphasized all the time that it was for an n-dimensional manifold, so there was nothing specific or special about four dimensions. On the other hand, though, if you're going to do gravity in more than four dimensions, you do have to justify why you're doing it physically and to see, you know, whether it makes sense. So, let's see. So Kaluza and Klein, back in the 1920s, had been thinking about ways of unifying electromagnetism and gravity. So when, I mean, Maxwell, so Einstein was very keen with this idea of a unified field theory, that somehow there ought to be a single description of all the interactions of nature. So this was following on from Maxwell, who unified electricity and magnetism. And of course, Einstein found that electromagnetism was very natural, very naturally unified as soon as you went to a relativistic description of space and time. And so there was this, you know, he's basically spent, after general relativity, spent more or less the rest of his life looking for this unified field theory. What Kaluza and Klein did, well, I think it was Kaluza first, was to actually find a rather unusual way of adding electromagnetism to general relativity. And what they did was to add an extra dimension. So initially, Kaluza just looked at gravity in five dimensions. Klein came up with the idea of it actually being hidden, i.e. small. And when you look at gravity in five dimensions, you can write, or you can think of the metric as splitting into a sort of pure 4x4 box. The fifth part, a G55, and then the terms down the side, which look like a vector field from a four-dimensional perspective. So just formally, you can separate out the degrees of freedom. Well, no, that suggests something physical. You can separate out the components of the metric into a 4x4 part, which of course is suggestively written G mu nu, a sort of mixed four-dimensional sort of fifth, so G5 mu bit, which looks like a vector field, and a scalar part, which is just G5 5. So what Kaluza-Klein theory then does is to say, let's suppose that nothing depends on that extra dimension. So they're saying that gravitational physics is four-dimensional, so everything here just depends on x mu. The sigma, the A field, and the G field. So they're saying that the metric, the geometry, is independent of this extra dimension. It's like a sort of free motion, free extra dimension. And then what they did was to work out what the Ricci tensor was of this space-time, and the Ricci scalar, if you like. They probably did it with the Ricci tensor and looked at the Einstein equations. And they showed that it looked very much like normal gravity with a gauge field, and they kind of ignored that. They assumed that wasn't there. Okay? And so that was their argument for how to unify gravity and electromagnetism. These simple translational modes in the extra direction, so-called zero modes, gave you gravity and electromagnetism with some assumptions. Okay? So they initially assumed so with psi being periodic, this was Klein's addition, you got an R4 cross S1 sort of vacuum, basic space, flat space. So in Kaluza-Klein theory, you hide the extra dimension by first supposing that nothing depends on it. So you're kind of freezing out, to a large degree, anything that would track the extra dimension. And secondly, you're making it periodic. And then in the back of your mind, you're assuming it's small. So quite often when in the sort of, you know, more than about 10 to 15 years ago, people would have assumed that these extra dimensions were more or less at the Planck scale or close to the Planck size. So in that sense, you've hidden this extra dimension. There's a sort of supposition that it's kind of going along for the ride. The only way in which it shows up are these extra fields. Okay? So as I say, the handout gives the details, but let me just sort of give you the key sort of steps that show why this gives you sort of more or less general relativity in electromagnetism. So we know how to compute curvatures for metrics. So we do this same process. We take an orthonormal basis. This is all in the notes. So notice this thing here, A mu dx mu, is just the gauge field as a one form. So if I want to, for example, compute the connection, then this part here is just the normal four-dimensional G mu nu piece. So this is going to give me just the four-dimensional connection, the connection of the four-dimensional metric. When I take d omega psi, I'm going to get two terms. I first of all see the e to the sigma, so that's just going to be d sigma cross omega psi. And then secondly, when d hits the term in brackets, it gives zero when it hits d psi, but of course dA is just F, the Maxwell field strength. So having gone through that, I can see that if I want to pick off my connection one forms, if I start with the psi one, you know what I mean, underlining things, I just forget. Then I see that the connection, that this is all in the handout, so don't panic about writing it down. The psi space-time, psi A connection one form, it picks up something from the d sigma piece, so that's coming from there, and it picks up an FAB term. But then what that means is if I look at theta AB, obviously it's going to start out as being the four-dimensional connection. But I can't leave it as that because d of omega A, remember, equals minus theta AB omega B minus theta A psi omega psi, right? So when I take theta A psi omega psi, wedge omega psi, I'm going to pick up an FAB term here, so I've got to make sure that I subtract that off. And so I have to add here an FAB omega psi. So that sort of tells you what the connection is. So you see already that just in terms of the connection, you're picking up Maxwell stress tensor terms. So you then compute the curvature two forms, and again, they're all done in detail on the handout. But again, just as an example, if we wanted to look at our psi A, then I would have to compute those pieces. So if I look here, I'm going to do this by shorthand. Ultimately, I know what I'm looking for is the Ricci tensor. So I'm only going to focus in on terms of this two form that are omega psi cross an omega b piece. The whole lot's in the handout. So again, I'm trying to do the signposts here. So when I take d of this, so the first term I've picked out, I've just taken d of sigma comma a. I've looked at d of omega psi, but then I've just picked off the bit here that has an omega psi in it. And then this second term here, I want to have omega psi's. So again, I'm going to have a theta psi b. So here it's a sigma comma b omega psi. And then I've got a theta 4 b a. So that is going to turn that term into a covariant derivative. And then finally, I've got, if I want B psi cross terms, I've got this last piece here, which gives me a quarter FBC omega C cross FBA omega psi. And then I've got plus omega A omega B terms. So that enables me to pick off what our psi A, psi B is. So, for example, that's that term. And you can play, you can do the same thing with the R to get R, A, B, C, D. But, you know, I've just focused in on something which is going to give me contributions to the Ricci tensor. There are, of course, off-diagonal terms. So when you go through all the steps, you find that you get, for the Ricci scalar, and hence if we were going to do the Einstein-Hilbert action, so you'd think, if you were looking at that, that you'd done your job. You've sort of got the Einstein, what looks like an Einstein term, and you've got F squared, so that's the action for electromagnetism. And you've got this extra piece, but, you know, maybe that's going to be okay. The problem is, of course, that this is just the Ricci scalar. The Einstein action has a root g in it. So when you calculate that g5, it's equal to the determinant of the four-dimensional metric times e to the sigma. Sorry, 2 sigma, I'm doing square root there. So that was the reason for writing the metric in the way that we did. You're peeling off the sort of five-dimensional part by including the gauge field in it, so that the overall determinant is just that scalar, which is telling you about the size of the fifth dimension, times the square root of the four-dimensional metric. So it's not so clear that you've got Einstein-Maxwell theory now, because you can get rid of this scalar term. By the time the e to the sigma goes in there, it's a total derivative. So you're still left with r plus f squared, but you do have this scalar pre-multiplying r and also pre-multiplying f squared. So this is in fact not Einstein gravity. It's what's known as scalar tensor gravity. Or Brown's Dickey is another. So the scalar field is, in some ways, it's playing a similar role. It's pre-multiplying R, so it's changing your effective gravitational constant with respect to this four-dimensional metric. So what people usually do is to try and make a transformation to return this to looking like Einstein gravity. So what you're doing then is you're rescaling your distances. So this is a conformal transformation, but I was told by Callum that I think you had a slightly different definition of conformal transformations in one of your other courses, but nonetheless, this is what I mean by conformal transformation. What the conformal transformation does is rescale the metric. So you're rescaling your distances by some possibly space-time dependent factor. This does not change angles, okay? And it does not change the light cone structure, because obviously ds squared is zero along a light cone. So in this sense, I've got to get my factors right. I can never remember whether they're logs. Six. So under a conformal transformation, the Ricci scalar rescales, but you also get something involving derivatives of this conformal function, omega. So what we do, which is again, I believe, in the handout, what we do is we choose an omega so that root g for r4 cancels off this e to the sigma term. And then finally, for the sake of argument, you rewrite the scalar. So that this is your final expression. I'll tilde that to make it, yeah.
Where do the components depend from? The indexes?
This is a four-dimensional Ricci tensor. So it's just got, it's only got non-zero components in the 4x4.
Okay.
So if you go through the handout, you'll see the way it's written down is that I have split my indices into 4 plus 1. And this is the 4 bit, yeah. So,
when you do the conformal transformation on the rest of all the other fields, do you have to worry about where the metrics hide?
Yes. So I'm only doing the gravitational action here. So this, I'll try and say a couple of words about this. Let me just get the action down. I know it's written in the Okay, no. So that is what the action is. What this has done is it's now put the gravitational part of the action into a sort of canonical form. So this is called the Einstein frame, because the gravitational action looks normal. Rescaling the scalar field was so the kinetic term for the scalar field looked normal. But there's no way in which you can get rid of this scalar in front of the electromagnetic field. And the reason is electromagnetism is conformally invariant in four dimensions. So you can never get rid. If there's a scalar field in front of it in one frame, it'll be in front of it in all frames. So if you have other matter, so this is okay, you can do a conformal transformation, and there's nothing really to tell you which is the right frame to use. And to some extent, it's a matter of personal preference which one you use. However, if you have other fields present, so let's just say some other scalar field, phi, then grant the action, kinetic action for phi, right, if it was some five-dimensional action, would be equal to, if I look at it in terms of this thing, e to the root 3 phi, little phi, g tilde mu nu, actually it's not even that simple. Yes, it is. So what you see now is that you've got couplings between the derivative terms of phi and the scalar. So you now start to make things much more complicated from the matter perspective. Okay, so again, it's a matter of personal preference. I would rather have gravity complicated and matter easy, because it's just, you know, I find it easier to just use non-Einstein frames. But some people prefer to work in a simple gravitational frame and just deal with the what happens to matter. So this means that things like masses of particles can change. And it's also the way, the way in which the particles couple to gravity changes. And that's not surprising, really, because the original frame, the non-Einstein frame, said that the scalar field was giving you a sort of space-time dependent gravitational coupling. So if you make that gravitational coupling fixed, then you should expect something to happen that changes like masses of particles. The physical effect can't just go away. You've just hidden it somewhere else. So this is now the sort of Kaluza-Klein result, that your gravitational action is, at least in some sense, Einstein-Maxwell, but with a twist. It's got this scalar field floating around. And I just put here, notice this L is just the length of the extra dimension. So that's that's basic Kaluza-Klein theory. And what I'd like to do now is talk about black holes. Because this will sort of introduce what what role this extra dimension plays. So one of the things that you first think about when you've got relativity is that there's no rest frame. There's no absolute time. That was sort of the change between Newtonian gravity or Newtonian mechanics and relativistic mechanics. But once you have done this compactification, you're taking an X5, so you're taking a frame, this is your psi, say, and T, you're identifying psi plus L with psi. You're making a strip, a cylinder, and then re-identifying it. As soon as you've done that, you actually have picked a rest frame. So because, if this is my light cone here, if I were to look at a different frame here, say psi prime t primed, okay, then a psi equals constant, say, is that parallel? Probably not. So this would be a strip of psi primed equals constant. So you can see that by identifying this point here with this point here, or in fact that point there with that point there, this is at t prime is zero, this is at some negative t prime. So you're no longer identifying at constant time, okay? So you're identifying in your original frame, t psi is identified with t psi plus L. But you see that that's not the same in the boosted frame. So you simply, you know, you're identifying different T primes and different psi primes. So that means that motion in the internal dimension has some actual distinct, you know, physical interpretation in four dimensions. Let's see what that might be. So we know that, I said that the Schwarzschild solution, if I added just a single flat extra dimension, was a solution to the Einstein equations. So this is a solution to the five-dimensional Einstein equations. So it's a solution to the five-dimensional Einstein equations if I do a boost along the psi direction. And so what I can do is I can boost my solution before periodically identifying. So I would turn that to dt plus v d psi over 1 minus v squared. So I can do that because that's simply a Lorentz transformation. So if I do that, then let me do that and then start trying to reorganize the T psi part of the metric to see if I rearrange things in that Kaluza-Klein form, what do I get? So if I look at the T psi part of the metric and simply multiply out, if I look at the dt squared pieces, well, I've got 1 minus 2gm on r times 1 over 1 minus v squared from the first bit, and then I've got here minus v squared over 1 minus v squared. The d psi squared piece, I've got 1 over 1 minus v squared minus v squared over 1 minus v squared into 1 minus 2gm on r. And then my cross terms both of them are going to be v over 1 minus v squared. And then I've got 1 minus 2gm on r minus 1. Okay, so if I put this lot together, gosh, I hope that's readable. So what I've done here is I've looked at the d psi squared piece, right? Because remember, when in the Kaluza-Klein breakdown, you had some function multiplying d psi plus a mu da mu. So here I've got to look at what that e to the 2 sigma, the original scalar function multiplying d psi squared, is. So if I look here, I've got a 1 over 1 minus v squared, and then I've got minus v squared over 1 minus v squared. So that gives me the 1. And then I simply get plus the 2gmv squared over r into 1 minus v squared. So that just work, you know, multiplying out that bracket gives me this term in here. Then I've got to absorb this cross term into that so that I pick out what my gauge field is. So in other words, here you can see that when you multiply this term here with this term here, this is this, if I, you know, top line 1 minus v squared r plus 2gmv squared, I get 2g or 4gmv over 1 minus v squared. So this is what I should end up with if I multiply everything out properly, which is no guarantee, of course. So finally, you've then got to, you've completed the square between d psi and dt, and so you've then got to add that term to the dt squared piece, and that's how you end up with what you've got there. So what's happened here is that you can see that you're picking up a gauge field which has a time component, and that this is not that different from the Schwarzschild potential, but maybe you need to redefine your r coordinate. So if I redefine that r coordinate, if I say that r hat is r plus 2gm v squared over 1 minus v squared, so that this is like something over r hat, then this here, if I say that, say a q is 2gm v over 1 minus v squared, then my gauge field looks like q over r hat. Which is the potential of an isolated charge. Yes. Yes. So you end up with 2gm over r times this slot.
Yep.
And I think if you multiply this out here, you'll see that that gives the same. Possibly up to a sign. No, it's the right sign. So what we've done there is we've actually found that this is the gauge potential of an electric charge. Moreover, if I look at this term, which is meant to be related to the scalar field, I always forget that it's plus or minus root 3 phi. So if I look here, this is picking off this term. So on the top, if I multiply top and bottom by r, I've got r hat on the top, and then on the bottom I've simply got r, which is r hat minus 2gm v squared over 1 minus v squared, so that's r hat minus q, sorry, vq. So what happens to the four-dimensional metric with all its conformal transformations and everything else done? So that's what a Kaluza-Klein black hole looks like with motion in the internal direction. The reason for these extra terms here is because we've done that conformal transformation to go to the Einstein frame, which means we pick up factors of e to the minus root 3 phi. So that's 1 minus VQ on R hat. So that's the reason for these terms sitting in here. So we've got an electrically charged black hole, but this doesn't look like the Riesman-Nordström solution, not quite. It's got these square roots of factors coming in. There's also, but there is a sort of notion of more than one zero. You've sort of got a zero which is coming from a mass, and a zero which is coming from a charge. So in some ways it's sort of got it's got some similarities. Now you can actually take what we call an extremal limit, which in Riesman-Nordström is just setting the mass equal to the charge. In which you take your Schwarzschild black hole and you boost it up to the speed of light, but at the same time you've got to get the mass to go to zero because only massless particles can travel at the speed of light. So you're setting V to 1 and such that M over 1 minus V is a fixed ratio. And so in that extremal limit, you see that, so in this case, that's another way of putting it, you actually find that your event horizon, or what was the event horizon, becomes singular. So it's as if you've, you know, here you've gone, you've actually sort of shrunk down, this conformal factor becomes singular. So your extremal limit of an electrically charged black hole is not well defined. But that's at least what it tells you is that motion in the internal dimension is associated with charge.
So with that singularity hanging behind the horizon before?
And yeah,
if you do this transformation, it actually brings it up to the horizon.
Yes, it's just like I suppose if you think about the Schwarzschild black hole, as n goes to zero, the Schwarzschild horizon goes to zero. So just in the limit, it's sort of a moot point, I suppose, but you could imagine that as you're tending to M equals zero, that, you know, you're getting closer and closer. The event horizon is getting closer and closer to the singularity. Of course, you'd want to cut off before you at the Planck mass or something, but so it's a formal limit, in a way, but that's sort of another way of seeing why you pick up the singularity. So that's an electrically charged black hole. What about a magnetically charged one? So in the case of Einstein gravity with genuine electromagnetism, you can get magnetically charged black holes gravitationally look the same as electrically charged black holes. And basically, this is sort of because of a property known as duality. Which is, if you take the geometric dual, so that's the epsilon tensor. If your indices are all downstairs, it's root g times the alternating symbol, which is either plus or minus 1, depending on the permutation of the indices. So you can always do this process of dualization. So again, in the sort of form language, this would be the Hodge dual of a form. And under this duality, simple Einstein-Maxwell theory is completely invariant. So if you're just doing Einstein-Maxwell, solutions, it can't tell if you've got an electric or a magnetic charge. It's only once you go to the gauge theory. As soon as you go to a gauge theory, then there is a difference, okay? So once you've got, say, electrically charged objects, then you know, well, unless you've got black holes or some other way of smoothing out the core, you don't have magnetic monopoles. So what we know, sort of, let's see how we could describe this. So for a magnetic charge, the field strength is sort of topological in a way. It's some Q measuring the units of charge times, and this is just the area form on a two-sphere. So obviously dF is zero. Now that you can source, not sourced, or rather the gauge potential, so I want to get something sine theta, d theta, d phi. So if an f is dA, so the obvious thing to do is to take minus cos theta d phi. But if I want it to be regular, then, say if I want it to be regular at the North Pole, then I need it to be smooth, to go to zero, because d phi is not defined at the North Pole. So this prefactor has to go to zero. So this is fine everywhere except at the South Pole, but I could have also written the following potential, which would be regular at the South Pole. So either of these expressions will give me the same F. So this difference between them should be a gauge transformation. So if that is going to be a gauge transformation, then I have to have that 2q phi is an allowed coordinate transformation. So I'm now going to apply this sort of setup to my Kaluza-Klein interpretation. So I really want to be thinking of that phi as being a psi. So from the Kaluza-Klein perspective, let me just write these gauge potentials. potentials down here, so we've got them. So these are my gauge fields, and I've got two different expressions, one of which is regular at the North Pole, the other of which is regular at the South Pole. So what I want to do is to define also a sort of psi north and psi south, so that my whole coordinate system, in terms of the five-dimensional metric, is regular at both North and South Poles. So obviously this means that the psi coordinate has to absorb this 2q phi term. So that means that, I think if I've got my signs right, Okay, if I put that coordinate transformation in there, then those two expressions are identical, they're exactly the same, but one is regular on the North Pole and one is regular on the South Pole. So this has to be an allowed coordinate transformation. So that means that it has to be some, I'll put it as the periodicity of psi, it has to be some unit times the periodicity of psi. Sorry, damn, I'm not explaining this well. So the phi coordinate, phi equals naught and phi equals 2 pi, are the same point. So that means that whether phi is naught or 2 pi, I have to have be at the same point on the manifold. So if I put in phi is 2 pi, I've got to be at the same point. So in other words, charge is quantized. So this is what the metric looks like. Magnetic black hole, but it's the five-dimensional metric note, and I've written it in this form for a very specific reason, and that is that the extremal limit is now when r plus goes to r minus, and in the extremal limit this just turns to one, and then you've got a common sort of factor of 1 minus r plus on r, which is pre-multiplying the extra dimension and the r squared d omega 2 squared. And what if you sort of pull off that factor of 1 minus r plus on r, you end up with something which is actually a coordinatization, or at least a squashing of a coordinatization of S3 in terms of what are called Euler angles. So what has happened here is that the magnetic charge, this you'd normally think in Kaluza-Klein theory you're adding an S1, and so your topology is something like, you know, a four-dimensional manifold cross S1. But that's not the case here, because you've got two coordinate patches, a north and a south. In between the coordinate patches, you're doing a twist of the psi but by a term proportional to phi. So if you think about taking a two-sphere and sewing chainmail on, if you were just doing an S2 cross S1, you would simply stitch the chainmail on uniformly over the two-sphere. But what you've done here is you've stitched it uniformly over the top, uniformly over the bottom, but when you glue them together around the equator, each time you sew together, so to speak, adjacent little patches of chainmail, you're doing a wee twist, and you're increasing your twist till you get to 2 pi when you've come all the way around. And what that's done is actually taken your S2 and sort of lifted it up into an S3. So it's what's called a hop vibration of an S. 1 over an S2, in this case giving an S3. So this thing in its extremal limit is actually completely non-singular, topologically R5, and it's, you know, it's actually got, it's called a Kaluza-Klein monopole. So it's got quite a few quite nice properties. So tomorrow, so if you want to read up more about hot vibrations, if you're that way inclined, I encourage you to do so. And tomorrow we'll look a little bit more now at issues of stability of some of these solutions, and I'll also do a little bit about perturbation theory. I know you've done this in, is it Renata's course? Yeah, although it wasn't clear whether she'd done it in a general background, not just around flat space. So we'll look at perturbation theory in a general background, think about degrees of freedom of the graviton and how they depend on the number of space-time dimensions, and then talk a bit about stability of some of these solutions. Sorry for overrunning a bit there.